The answer is no. The entire time I knew her, did I ever see this alleged gear? No, again. Just because some cop put it in the police report doesn't make it true. I stood and stared at him, processing what he'd said. I was about to remind him I hadn't read the police report, but that was beside the point. He'd reverted to whitewashing Audrey's character. But what had caused the shift? I glanced over at Earldine, who propped her chin on her fist, fascinated by the discussion. I wanted to slap her face, but thought better of it. He said, "This is refreshing. For once, you're at a loss for words." "Because what I'm hearing you say is you now believe Audrey was the victim of a conspiracy that originated with the police."
"Makes a lot more sense to me than your theory."
"What prompted your change of heart?"
"There's no change of heart. I said from the get-go she was innocent. So what if she snitched at Teddy? For cripe's sake, that doesn't make her a hardcore criminal."
I shut my mouth and let him run on.
"You know what your problem is?" he asked.
He pointed with his cigarette, which came perilously close to my face.
"You want to believe the worst about people. Doesn't matter to you if there's proof or not."
"What are you talking about?"
"You were married to a police officer accused of beating a guy to death, right?"
"I told you about that."
"No, you did not. You mentioned you were married to a cop who was a friend of Detective Pretty's, and you said Pretty was a creep. What you didn't say was your ex-husband was exonerated. Interesting you elected to leave that part out."
"I don't see the relevance."
"You don't? Well, think about it. You were so sure you were right you abandoned the guy when he needed you most."
He dropped his cigarette on the floor and stepped on it. "It didn't happen that way," I said.
"You can quibble all you like, but I'm close enough. Am I correct?"
"Marvin, you're trying to draw a parallel between my relationship with my ex and my belief in Audrey's guilt. You're saying Mickey was eventually cleared and therefore she will be too. Is that it?"
"Right. And she's dead, same as the guy you were married to."
He looked skyward and tapped his chin like a cartoon character.
Let's see. What do these two stories have in common?"
I said, "Those two situations are so different, I can't even begin to set you straight."
"Don't be so defensive. I'm just telling you what I was told."
"By Len Pretty."
"I didn't say it was him."
"Of course it was." He shrugged.
"You don't like the guy. That doesn't mean he's trying to do you in," he said. "At any rate, I apologize for being rude. I should have asked why you're here. Let me guess. You used up the balance of the retainer and you're hoping to hit me up for more."
"That's true. But the game has changed, hasn't it?" I said mildly. I was keeping my voice low because my rage was rising to a white-hot peak, and I didn't dare give vent to it.
"Oh, geez. Now you're pissed off. I hope you're not telling me you quit," he said facetiously.
"Quit? No, sweetheart. I'm in this for the long haul, whether you pay me or not." He drew back.
"You can't do that. I won't have you meddling in her affairs. Audrey's past is none of your business."
"Sorry to disagree, but this is my job and I'm on it. Too bad you didn't fire me when you had the chance." Chapter 22. Dante. Dante counted laps as he swam, his mouth lifting to the left to take in a breath of air, turning into the water to release. There was little sound beyond the bubbles he breathed out. He was conscious of the strength of his arms as he moved through the water, hands slicing down, pulling through, propelling himself forward. He recited the numbers in his head with each stroke. 18, 18, 18. Down the length of the pool. 17, 17, 17. On the return. It was easy to lose track of where he was and how far he'd come when the water was such a perfect temperature, and there was nothing to interrupt the easy flow of energy. The noisy chatter in his head gave way to the simple repetition. Arms, legs, inhale, exhale. The day after his mother left, Pop had drained the pool at the house where they lived, leaving a great empty hole in the ground to remind them of the pleasures she'd taken with her. Rain and falling leaves had rotted together, filling the bottom with black sludge. Dante knew his father had done it out of spite, to deprive them of the solace she'd offered and the confidence she'd instilled. Whatever pain she'd inflicted on her husband, he'd doubled when he'd passed it on to his son. Dante hadn't gone back into the water until he bought this house and had his own pool put in. The last lap was the best. By then, his body was relaxed and his mind was still. After the final few strokes, when he lifted himself out of the water and onto the concrete apron, his limbs felt rubbery and loose. He'd press a towel against his face, flush with the heat the exercise had generated. Where lifting weights pumped his muscles, the swimming stretched him out and kept him long and lean. He'd see Nora in the afternoon, if she decided to come. By the time he reached the master suite, his body heat had dissipated, and he needed a hot shower to offset the chill. Usually on Sunday mornings he didn't shave, but he did so today. Because of Nora, of course. Since he'd first set eyes on her, everything was about Nora. He couldn't identify the draw, and he didn't question it. It had never happened to him before, and he had no explanation. What difference did it make why he was obsessed? In point of fact, he was. He peered into the bedroom. Lola was still asleep, buried under the weight of the comforter. She had so little body fat, she was cold all the time. During the night, if she snuggled up against him, her skin was as cold as naga hide. He eased the dressing room door shut and pulled on his clothes. Light pants, a red silk shirt, loafers without socks. Sophie had Sundays off, so he was alone when he wandered into the kitchen. The counters were gleaming, and the stainless steel appliances gave off a silvery light. The coffee pot was pre-programmed, and the insulated carafe was full. Sophie had made him a coffee cake that she'd covered in saran wrap. He cut a generous slice and ate it with one hand while he poured his coffee with the other. He added milk and carried the mug with him as he moved through the tunnel to his office in the cottage. Lola mocked his passion for underground passageways, but he found it satisfying to travel from place to place unseen. She claimed it was his way of returning to the womb, an assertion he found annoying. What did she know about anything? In his mind, it was about the ability to escape. He was a man who always had a way out. From the cottage, he crossed the lawn to the guest house. The nurse on duty had been looking after his uncle for the past 5 months. She was close to 6 feet tall and built like an athlete, all muscle and sinew. Strong features, short cropped blonde hair. He'd dated her 9 years before, though the relationship was short-lived. Cara was promiscuous by nature and thought nothing of taking up with any man who came along. A woman would do if a guy wasn't available. When she applied for the job, he'd hesitated, wondering if it was wise to have her so close by. Lola's neediness would surface, and he'd have to shore her up with constant reassurances. He needn't have worried. 9 years was 9 years, and the physical attraction had faded. Cara was competent, and she worked hard, and he knew his Uncle Alfredo liked looking at her. She met him at the door. "He's been waiting for you. He woke up at midnight and wanted company. We played gin rummy and watched television for most of the night. I don't know where he gets the energy." Dante followed her into the living room where his Uncle Alfredo was seated by the fireplace, wrapped in a big puffy yellow comforter. April nights were still chilly, and the mornings were not much warmer. Dante crossed to the fireplace, leaned down, and kissed the top of his uncle's head. Alfredo grabbed his hand
and clung to it, laying it up against his cheek.
You're a good boy, Dante. Let me say that while I have the opportunity.
When he finally let go, Dante pulled up a chair and sat down across from him. How goes the battle?
About like you'd expect.
This morning's not so bad. Kara says you were up half the night.
I'm afraid I'll die in my sleep.
Don't want the Grim Reaper catching you unawares?
I intend to put up a fight, Alfredo said. Your father came to see me yesterday. We had a long talk.
Let me guess. He thinks I'm too hard on Cappy. He wants me to hand over the bail and let him run the circuit.
That was the gist of it. Not that I'm siding with Lorenzo, but how's the kid going to learn responsibility if he's never given any? I'm not making a judgment here, so don't get on your high horse. I'm just asking.
The kid, as you so aptly refer to him, is 46 years old. I think he's already demonstrated his capacity for growth and maturity, Dante said. Cappy takes advantage. He wheedles and whines, and the next thing you know, Pop thinks he's come up with the idea himself.
No doubt about it. Cappy pays me a visit. I know he's working an angle, maneuvering for support.
He's not getting it from me. I may make a show of teaching him the system, but I'm not going to cut him in on the profits from an operation worth millions. You think that's a good idea? You're nuts. Alfredo tilted his head, his tone mild.
Here's another way of looking at it. How many years you've been saying you want out of the business? This might be your opportunity.
Doesn't work that way. I'm 54 years old. What would I do? Go to medical school? Get a law degree? It's too late. Pop expected me to do this, and I'm doing it. Now he expects me to turn the biggest chunk of it over to Cappy, who fucks up everything he does. I won't do it.
How are you going to get around it when he's made up his mind?
He can make up his mind about anything he wants. I'm the one in control. Anyway, ask me. He's losing it. He's talking about Amo and Donatello like they're in the next room.
He's forgetful sometimes. Happens to all of us.
Not you, Dante said.
I'm a special case, Alfredo said wryly.
Big problem you got is Lorenzo doesn't always see what Cappy's up to.
You should put a stop to it before it gets out of hand.
How? His uncle's face registered distress.
What's the matter with you? You know better. That's not a question you should ever have to ask.
Alfredo studied him briefly.
You know what your problem is.
I'm sure you'll enlighten me.
You've gone all dainty on me. There was a time when you'd have taken care of this. No talk, no hesitation.
Dante smiled. Dainty? That's a first.
You know what I mean. Man in your position can't afford a conscience. It's unbecoming. You don't back away from what's difficult. You do what needs to be done.
You don't believe we are what we do.
Of course. We just have to accept that about ourselves. That we're corrupt. That our sins are mortal. God knows mine lie heavy on my soul.
And you wish the same torment on me?
You know what's right.
Not what's right. I know what's expedient. I'm trying to rise above it for a change. Uncle Alfredo shook his head.
Contrary to your nature.
I'd like to think I'm a better man at this late stage in my life.
Your brother doesn't share your moral sensibilities, which gives him the upper hand.
That's how he looks at any rate. Dante took his own car, a 1988 Maserati, silver with a black leather interior. He arrived at the hatch at 12:45. Parked his car around the corner. He'd given his chauffeur and his bodyguard the day off, opting instead for a loaded Colt lightweight commander that he kept in a special compartment in the driver's side door. He'd instituted the heavy security measures 2 years before when a Colombian gang set up shop in Perdido, 25 miles south of Santa Teresa. A crew of 10 came to town, 6 men and 4 women, using driver's licenses that identified them as Puerto Ricans.
They were, in fact, trampling on territory run by a friend of his who was a Puerto Rican by birth and took offense. Not only at their encroachment, but at their maligning his country of origin. Since Dante's friend was in prison at the time, he'd volunteered to have his own men step in. They cornered the Colombians in a motel room where a faulty heater exploded, killing the occupants and blowing off half the roof. After that, the remaining Colombians kept their distance, but let it be known they'd settled the score in their own good time. Dante's friend had been felled by a sniper's bullet his first day out of prison, and from that point on, Dante insisted on armed household guards and armor-plated transportation. Entering the hatch, Dante nodded at Ollie and took a table in view of the door. He wanted a bourbon and water, but decided to abstain. Ordering a drink seemed like a cheat, as though seeing Nora again was something he couldn't manage without being fortified with booze. He wasn't sure what he'd do if she didn't show. He was just as anxious at the idea that she would show. Then what? He'd told himself to have no expectations, but he did. There was an impressive gathering of patrons at the bar, faces he'd seen on previous occasions. He hadn't been at the hatch for months, but nothing had changed. He looked around, seeing the place as Nora would see it, shabby and unappealing. No charm, no character. He'd chosen the spot because, as he'd said to her, there was no danger she'd run into anyone she knew. Those in her social circle had probably never heard of the bar and wouldn't be caught dead there if they had. His gaze strayed to the door, which stood open, admitting a column of daylight, smoky at the edges, as though a filter had been placed over a camera lens. The haze infused the room with a vintage air, a World War II movie set against a backdrop of loss and death and betrayal. That was a cheerful prospect. He didn't know her at all, had no idea, for instance, whether she was punctual or habitually late. He checked his watch and saw that it was 1 o'clock straight up. 10 more minutes and he'd either order a drink or get up and leave. She was a happily married lady, or said she was. So why would she meet him here, or anywhere else for that matter? She was elegant. She had class. She was reserved and self-contained. There was something in her face that made him want to weep, that made him long to see her again, whatever the cost. It was 1:03 when she appeared in the doorway, blocking the light briefly as she came in. He stood. She saw him and crossed the room. He held a chair for her, and she sat down. She wore a white wool suit with a short skirt. The jacket was neatly fitted, and where the lapels met the collar, there was a rim of red lace. He nearly reached out and slid a finger down between her breasts. He said, "I didn't think you'd come." Her smile was brief. "I doubted it myself." Her gaze flicked from the lighted neon beer sign mounted on the wall to the bar, and from there to the cartoon arrow that pointed to the ladies' room. "I'd offer to buy you a drink, but you're not comfortable." "Of course not. All this cigarette smoke. By the time I get home, my clothes will stink and I'll have to wash my hair. I've got a better idea. Place I want to show you. You'll like it." "We're going someplace else?" "Don't be so nervous. Nothing's going to happen to you." She dropped her gaze. "I have time constraints." "We're not leaving town," he said. "Let me correct myself. A short distance out of town, 15 minutes max." "What about my car?" "I'll bring you back. What time do you have to be home?"
4.
"Not a problem." When he got up, she put a restraining hand on his arm. "Drop me at my car and I'll follow you," she said. He leaned close to her ear, taking in the smell of her hair, and the light scent of lilac coming off her skin. "You just want to be in control." She seemed to shiver at the touch of his breath. "That's what you want, isn't it?" He stood up and held her chair. "Where are you parked?"
"Around the corner."
"Me too. I'll walk you out the side door. That way you won't have to parade past these yahoos. They've been staring at you." He took her arm lightly, shielding her from view.
"Where are you taking me?" I'm not telling you. This is an experiment in trust. Why would I trust you? You already do. Evil as I am, I've got an honest face. You're not evil, are you? Not entirely. Then again, I'm not entirely honest. He saw her to her car, a snappy teal-blue Thunderbird in mint condition. Somehow it pleased him. He was parked three cars behind her. He turned the key in the ignition and pulled out. She waited until he'd passed before she pulled out behind him. He let her down surface streets, watching her in his rearview mirror. She kept pace with him. As he drove through each stoplight, he was careful she made it through the intersection as well. When he reached the 101, he took the southbound on-ramp and continued for a mile. He got off at Paloma Lane, which ran parallel to the freeway on a wide stretch of land that bordered the Pacific Ocean. The railroad had co-opted the right-of-way some years before, but aside from the thundering of the trains passing twice a day, this was prime real estate. Most houses couldn't be seen from the road, which meant that privacy was guaranteed. The mix of evergreens and eucalyptus cut the sunlight into patches. He slowed and activated an automated gate of weathered wood. The houses on either side of the property were hidden behind Eugenia hedges, some 30 feet high. He turned into the driveway and followed it around to the left until it widened to a motor court sufficient for 6 cars. He parked and got out. He waited until she'd pulled in behind him and parked, and then he opened her car door. He offered her a hand and helped her out. "This is your house?" she asked. "A weekend place. No one knows it's mine." As they walked toward the front door, he took out a set of keys. The exterior of the house was board and batten, painted yellow. The windows shuttered in white. The roof was standing seam metal with a low pitch that suggested the architecture of the tropics, Key West or Jamaica. Palms were grouped in the small yard, which was half sand, half grass. The front door swung back, and she stepped into the small foyer, pausing to take in the space. The front wall of the living room was floor-to-ceiling windows. Just outside, there was a wide wooden deck enclosed by a board and batten barrier wall, waist-high, topped with darkly tinted glass panels, which kept the ocean visible while anyone standing on the deck was screened from view. She walked as far as the glass and looked out. The air was fully saturated with the scent of ocean, and Dante watched her close her eyes and inhale. "You like it?" She smiled at him. "It's perfect. I love the ocean. I'm a water baby. Pisces."
"Me too.
Only I'm Scorpio."
"How long have you had the place?"
3 days.
"You bought it this week?"
"Lease purchase agreement. You're my first guest."
"I'm flattered.
You want to look around? I can give you the tour."
"I'd like that."
The two moved from room to room. His commentary was minimal because the house was small and the spatial designations were self-evident. Kitchen, big master bedroom, 1 guest room, 2 baths, living room with a dining area at one end. The place was furnished right down to the bed linens. She said,
"I like buying on impulse. It's fun. I confess I can't imagine doing it on such a scale."
"It was a good deal all around. The guy owns the house owes me money, so he's paying off a debt. I called and told him I wanted it, and he was happy to oblige. The $15,000 a month includes the VIG. We close in 36 months. A bargain, from his perspective."
Nora seemed taken aback. "How much did he owe you?"
"A lot. I offered him a discount to sweeten the deal."
"Why would someone have to borrow that much?"
"Cost of living's up. The market's down. The guy's well known in town, and he has a front to maintain. His wife has no idea how far in a hole he is."
"Don't they use the house?"
"Not anymore. He told her he sold it."
"Just like that?"
"Sure."
"And her name wasn't on the deed?"
"Her name's not on anything. He's like Channing in that respect. She hesitated, perhaps reluctant to pursue the point. But curiosity got the better of her. Meaning what?
I'm guessing the Malibu house is in his name.
He owned it before we met.
So when you married him, he declared it his sole and separate property.
Of course. I have separate property as well. We've both been married before, so it's only right.
What about the house up here? Your name on the title?
Well, no. But he said it was for tax reasons. I can't remember now how he explained it.
How many times was he divorced before you married him?
Nora held up two fingers.
Bet he got taken both times, yes?
According to him.
That's why your name's not on the title. Because he's screwing you in advance.
Stop that. This is a community property state. If we divorce, I get half of everything regardless.
Nora, he's an attorney. All his friends are attorneys. And if not, they know other attorneys whose sole purpose in life is to keep assets out of the hands of women like you. The tax reasons he referred to? Guys call that the stupid tax. Paying through the nose because they haven't played it smart.
I don't think we should be discussing this. It's inappropriate.
Inappropriate? Well, that's one way to look at it. You want my take?
You're a beautiful woman. You're in trouble and you know it. I can see it in your face.
The way I read you, there's a reckless streak in you a mile wide. You used to be a wild child and you did as you pleased.
I thought that's what being young was about.
My point exactly. This is how we get old. Thinking too much about things we used to do without any thought at all.
Please, don't go on with this.
Why not?
I shouldn't have come here. I made a mistake.
We're having a conversation. There's nothing wrong with that.
You know better.
Yes, I do. I wasn't sure you did. That's the problem with choices. Eventually, you have to decide. Maybe not right this minute, but soon, he said.
What about you? What do you want? You fault me for indecision, but you haven't declared yourself.
For starters, I'd like to avoid spending the rest of my life in prison.
Is that a possibility?
According to my attorneys, I have four of them and they're top guns. I mention their names and trust me, Channing would know who they are.
What did you do?
The question is, what am I accused of doing? You want to hear the list?
Of course.
Income tax evasion, filing false returns, failing to report offshore bank accounts and international income. Also racketeering, conspiracy, money laundering, interstate transportation of stolen property, sale of stolen goods. That about sums it up. Well, mail fraud. I don't think I mentioned that. There might be a few I forgot, but most are variations on a theme.
No violent crimes?
Those charges were filed separately. The ones I mentioned are all under the RICO Act.
Will you be convicted?
Not if I can find a way out. My attorneys tell me the feds will offer a plea bargain, but the terms won't be nice.
What kind of sentence are you looking at?
40 years. Plus forfeiture of a shitload of property, which really pisses me off.
40 years? Wow. I'm sorry to hear that. I don't think I'll wait, but I'll miss you.
He laughed. It hasn't happened yet. The good news is these investigations move forward at the typical government pace. Glacial. It'll take them years. In the meantime, there are contingencies in place.
Well, that's interesting. What contingencies?
I've told you enough. The point is, if I opt out, you might consider going with me. There's more than one kind of prison. Don't be theatrical. I'm stating a fact. Stay married to Channing and you know what you're in for. He'll have a string of affairs that everyone will know about before you do. The best you can hope for is an affair of your own.
Which is where you come in.
Why not?
I'm not trying to talk you into anything, except maybe taking off with me when the time comes. I should go. It's not even 2 o'clock. You don't have to be home until 4. She laughed. You're bad. If I'm not careful, I'll end up calling my therapist about you. You're in therapy? I was. Twice a week for a year. Why? I lost a child. You want to talk about it? No. Did therapy help? No. That's why I quit. I got tired of the sound of my own voice. Grieving is like being ill. You think the entire world revolves around you, and it doesn't. He reached out and stroked her cheek with the back of his hand. Poor little sparrow. Yes. Poor me, she said. But she didn't pull away. Monday morning, Saul came into Dante's office with a thick packet of papers in hand. We've got a problem. Dante was sitting at his desk, toying with a letter opener that he then tossed to one side. He folded his hands in front of him. He was not a happy man, and the last thing he needed was another problem. What? Georgia called. She needs to meet with you. Why is that a problem? Tell her I'll pick her up at the usual place. That's not the problem I was referring to. Forget the bad news. You look grimmer than usual, and I don't want to hear about it. Saul was silent. Aggravated, Dante said, Fuck you, what? Maybe I can come back later. Dante made an out-with-it gesture with his hand. The payroll was intercepted. That's why Georgia wants to talk to you. Some schmo in Miami didn't get word Audrey was out of the loop, so he shipped the cash as usual. Her landlady intercepted the package. The money's gone. What do you mean, gone? When was this? Friday. And Georgia's just now reporting in? Tell her to get it the fuck back. She tried, only now there's a local private eye in the mix. I guess she and the landlady are in it together. Georgia sent guys to both places, here and up there, and there's no trace. Rumor has it they turned it over to the sheriff's department in San Luis Obispo. Well, that's terrific, Dante said. What else? Georgia thinks the PI has been tailing her. Georgia's PMSE. Every 30 days she turns paranoid and thinks someone's after her. Fucking drama queen. Sounds convincing to me. Maybe you ought to hear it from her. Dante waved a dismissive hand. Fine. You got more? Because so far you've only darkened my mood by half. You can do better than that. I wondered if you'd given any further thought to Cappy. He's asking too many questions, and I don't like his drift. I gave him a nugget of information, and we'll see what he does with it. I told him we purge business records every Thursday at noon. I made it up on the spot, but what does he know? He's double-dealing, he'll hightail it back to whoever's running him and tattle on us. I figure the feds will show up with search warrants and tear the place apart, destroy his credibility, and then what's he worth? Why would anyone believe a story like that? By the time he blabs, he'll have the facts so fucked up no one will know what to think. They'll come after us on the off chance the asshole's telling the truth. Nice to know something's under control. Dante pointed at the papers Saul had brought in. What's that? Saul put the sheaf on Dante's desk. The latest pound of pretrial paperwork. You want to go over it? What for? I'm screwed either way. I lie, they got me for perjury. I tell the truth, I'm down the toilet. What am I supposed to do? What's to debate? You lie through your teeth. It's up to them to prove otherwise. I don't like the idea of lying under oath. It might seem like splitting hairs given things I've done in my life, but I've got standards like everyone else. Then go to Plan B. Get out of the line of fire. How can I do that? I step to one side, that leaves you exposed. Don't worry about me. I'll be fine. If you're out of the picture, I can plead ignorance and blame it all on you. It is on me. I'll tell Luell it's a go any time you like. Not yet. I've got things I want to take care of first. Like what? Everything's in place. We've been working on this for months.
I know, Dante said irritably. I just don't think now's the time.
Cautiously, Saul said, And why is that?
There's this woman I'm seeing.
It took a brief moment for Saul to absorb what he'd said.
What about Lola?
That's over. She's still in the house, but she'll be gone before long.
I had no idea.
Me neither. She's the one who called it off, or I'd still be in there fighting. I thought we were good. I was playing for keeps.
Shows how much I know, he said.
Meantime, I met someone else.
Who?
Don't worry about that. The point is, I'm in way over my head.
You?
Who else are we talking about?
Since when?
Since yesterday.
Chapter 23. First thing Monday morning, on my way into the office, I stopped by the Hall of Records and started a paper search, looking for information about Helping Hearts, Healing Hands. If the organization was a charity, it would have to be registered. In the state of California, as in most states, I'm sure, any group seeking to obtain tax-exempt status is required to fill out forms, which are filed with the state, accompanied by the requisite filing fees. Whether the entity is a sole proprietorship, a partnership, a limited partnership, or a corporation, the applicant must list the name and address of the organization itself, and the name and address of every partner, trustee, or officer. I tried the Registry of Charitable Trusts, which netted me nothing. I tried looking under nonprofits and reached another dead end. Baffled, I asked the clerk at the desk if she had a suggestion. She suggested I try fictitious business names, also known as DBAs, short for Doing Business As. She directed me to another office. DBAs expire after 5 years, but a refiling is required within 30 days. I thanked her for her help. This time I was in luck, though the answer to the question took me right back to my starting point. Helping Hearts, Healing Hands was owned and operated by Dan Prestwick, husband of the very Georgia I'd been tailing for days. It wasn't clear what his purpose was in establishing this enterprise, but I assumed he'd acquired the proper licenses and permits, that he'd been assigned a federal tax ID number, and behaved himself in accordance with federal and state regulations in furtherance of his stated goals, whatever those might be. He was supposed to list funds, property, and other assets, but I couldn't see any sign that he'd done so. I was sure people were dumping all manner of household items and used clothing in his donation bins, but I wasn't sure what happened to the goods afterward. He certainly didn't declare the potential value. Maybe he turned around and dumped the same goods into Salvation Army bins, or left them at the drop-off point behind the Goodwill shop on Chapel. Helping Hearts, Healing Hands appeared to be a shell company created to shelter Dan Prestwick from closer scrutiny. My best guess was this so-called charity was a conduit for stolen merchandise. Georgia did some of the journeyman shoplifting, and she also had a hand in collecting stolen goods, judging from the bulging plastic bags she dumped in two separate bins as I looked on. Apparently, she wasn't involved in the transportation of goods from point to point. My guess was that she offloaded the stolen items as quickly as possible, passing them along to others in the loop. I couldn't picture the Prestwicks at the top of the heap. More likely, they were employed by someone higher up on the food chain. Audrey's calls to Los Angeles, Corpus Christi, and Miami suggested an organization with branches in ports of call across the country. Somewhere along the line, cash had been generated and shipped to the now deceased Audrey Vance. She probably used the money to pay the workers she'd assembled every other Saturday. Now what? I left the county building and drove back to Juniper Lane. I parked two doors down from the Prestwick's house and stared at the narrow slice of driveway I could see. I wasn't officially on surveillance. I needed a place to sit while I sorted myself out, and why not in range of two principal players? I took my index cards from the depths of my shoulder bag and made a few notes, discouraged by the paucity of facts. I had lots of good guesses and little evidence. Now that Marvin Stryker and I had parted company, I was on my own. While I liked not having to answer to him, I wouldn't net a nickel for my services. This is a dumb way to run a business, especially when the usual bills came due and I'd find myself short on funds. I have a savings account to cover shortfalls, but I don't fancy dipping into it. Despite my huffy claims to the contrary, I couldn't afford to work for long without pay. The sensible course of action would be to collate the data I'd collected and hand it over to Cheney Phillips. I had no intention of dealing with Len Priddy, but if Cheney wanted to pass on the information, that was up to him. I caught movement ahead and watched as Georgia emerged from her driveway on foot. She wasn't dressed for exercise unless she leaned toward jogging in a tight skirt, pantyhose, and strappy spike-heel shoes. She reached the corner and paused. As I looked on, a long black limousine pulled into view. The back door swung open, and she got in, after which the limousine glided out of my line of sight. I fired up the Mustang and drove to the end of the block, where I nosed forward slightly and peered to my right. The limousine had pulled over to the curb, and it sat there, engine idling. A very large man in a black suit had stepped out. He stood beside the vehicle, hands neatly folded in front of him, while he scanned the immediate area. His gaze came to rest on my car, and I had no choice but to turn left and drive on as though that had been my intent. I didn't even have time to pick up a plate number, which I could see was becoming a habitual failing of mine. Once again, I cursed the grabber blue Mustang, which was much too conspicuous. I couldn't even speed around the block and approach from the opposite direction. I returned to the office, and as I pulled up in front, I saw Pinky Ford sitting on my porch step, a manila envelope in hand. I'd been looking forward to time on my own, but this was apparently not in the cards. When he saw me, he stood up and dusted off the seat of his pants. He wore the usual jeans, this time with a western cut shirt, black with silver studs up one side like upholstery tacks. He'd been there for some time, judging by the number of dead cigarette butts at his feet. As I approached, he tucked the envelope under one arm and bent down to collect the butts. He held them, cupped in one hand, while he made a show of rubbing out the ashes with the toe of one boot. I said, "Hey, Pinky, how are you? I hope you're not here to tell me you hawked something else." "No, ma'am. I've been good," he said. "About that, at any rate." I unlocked the door, and he followed me in. "I can make a pot of coffee if you like. I'm kind of in a hurry. You want to have a seat, or would that take too long?" "I can sit," he said. I pulled the trash can from under my desk and held it out to him, waiting while he deposited his cigarette butts and wiped his hands on his jeans. Personally, I'd have loved a cup of coffee, but I postponed the pleasure in the interest of speed and efficiency. He settled on the guest chair and placed the manila envelope on my desk. As I looked over, I saw that the light on my answering machine was winking merrily. "Hang on." I pressed play, and the minute I heard, "This is Di," I punched delete. Pinky said, "Geez, I can tell you're fond of her." "Long story," I said. "Is that for me?" He pushed the envelope forward an inch. "I was hoping you could hang on to it temporarily." "What is it?" "Photographs." "Of?" "Two different individuals in compromising circumstances. It's better if you don't know the particulars." "Why is it better? It doesn't sound better to me." "The subject matter's on the sensitive side. In the first set, someone's reputation and good name are at stake." "You with another woman?" "Not me. I don't have a good name or reputation, either one. Besides which, I wouldn't fool around on Dodie. She's explained in some detail what she'd do to me if I strayed. What about the other set? Second's more serious. I'd say life or death if it didn't sound like I was blowing smoke up your skirt. How many photographs altogether? Doesn't matter, I'm just curious, I said. He thought about that like the idea hadn't occurred to him before. I'd say 10. You're guessing 10 or you've actually counted them? I counted. There's also the negatives. Copies without the negatives aren't worth shit. Destroy one set and all a fella has to do is print them up again. Why give them to me? He paused to remove a fleck of tobacco from his tongue. Good question, he said without volunteering a response. Pinky, I'm not going to hang on to anything unless you tell me what's going on. Understood, he said. He looked up at the ceiling. Let's see how I can explain and still exercise my Fifth Amendment rights. Take your time. He thought for a moment. I may have picked my way into the premises of a person I believed was in possession of the material in the envelope. I'm not saying I did, but it's possible. It's also possible I'd looked for the items elsewhere, and when they didn't come to light, I deduced their whereabouts. Why get involved in the first place? I wanted to eliminate the threat to a friend of mine. In the process, these other pictures came to light, and that's what's put me in a bind, big time. Doesn't that suggest that anyone holding the photographs would be in trouble if someone else figured it out? Why would anyone suspect you? What if you were followed? There could be a guy parked down the block with binoculars trained on my door. You come in with the envelope, you leave without it. The bad guys aren't stupid. I don't care who they are, they're going to figure it out. He shifted in his chair, apparently discomfited by the idea. The look he turned on me was shrewd. You could give me another manila envelope to carry with me when I leave. I squinted. You know what? This really doesn't sound like a good plan to me. You know I'd help you if I could, but you've dug yourself a hole, and I don't want to fall into it with you. This was not the response he was looking for. How about I leave the photos for one day? How do I know you'll come back for them? Because I got a good use for them, but not right away. This is just for safekeeping. One day. He held up one finger to dramatize the time frame, like the number one was somehow ambiguous. I know you better than that. You'll do what's expedient, and I'll be stuck. Promise I'll come back for them, I swear. I don't understand why one day will make a difference. I'm setting up a meeting for tomorrow afternoon. I'm in a jam, and the photos are my get-out-of-jail-free card. But only if I get them to the relevant party. Meantime, you could put the envelope in your safe and forget it's there. What makes you think I have a safe? The look he gave me was pained, like it was obvious. I'll pick him up by noon tomorrow, and that's the last you'll hear. I wanted to slam my fingers in the pencil drawer, which in the end would have been less painful than his proposal. Please don't ask me to do this. I am asking you. I'm desperate. He managed to look solemn and plaintive and helpless and dependent. I stared at him. Jailbirds are so often like this, I thought. In prison or out, they wheedle and manipulate. Maybe they can't help it. They chain themselves to the proverbial railroad tracks, knowing good souls like me will gallop to the rescue. When I do, as predicted, guess who ends up under the train? Everything in me cried out in protest. How many times have I said yes in situations like this with disastrous results? How many times have I fallen for just such a pitch? The purpose of intuition is to warn us when the wolf arrives at the door dressed as Little Red Riding Hood. I opened my mouth, not even certain what would come out. Something about this doesn't feel right to me, I said. Actually, none of it feels right. You're the only friend I have. Stop that. There has to be somebody else. He shrugged, refusing to look me in the eye. Let's hope. Otherwise, I'm in a world of hurt. I sat there wondering which was worse, making the wrong decision and having a load of shit rain down on my head, or avoiding calamity and feeling overwhelmed with guilt. That was the moment that nearly did me in. I teetered on the brink and finally shook my head. I can't. I'm sorry, but if I agree, I'll regret it. He stood up and I followed suit. When he reached across the desk to shake my hand, he managed to convey a sense of finality. I don't want you to feel bad for turning me down. I shouldn't have put you in this position. I hope you figure it out. Me too. Meanwhile, I appreciate your time. You take care now. I can let myself out. Will you keep in touch? If possible, he said. We exchanged awkward goodbyes, and then he left my inner office, moving toward the outside door. I truly wondered if I'd ever see him again. I returned to the office window and looked out. It took a few seconds before he appeared in my field of vision. I should have known he was up to something, but I didn't think anything of it at the time. I leaned my head against the glass, watching as he disappeared down the street. I half expected to hear gunfire or the squeal of tires as a license plate-free vehicle accelerated and ran over him. I sank into my swivel chair and experienced the full weight of my remorse. Next time he asked for anything, if he lived long enough, I'd say yes no matter what. This was one of those little-did-I-know moments, though I wasn't aware of it at the time. I don't know how long I might have sat there berating myself, but I had another visitor. I heard a tap on the outside door, which then opened and closed. I got up and crossed to the door, peering around the frame to find out who'd come in. Marvin's bar buddy, Earl Dean, was in the process of taking off her coat. It crossed my mind he might have sent her to apologize, being too cowardly and too embarrassed to do so himself. I said, "Hey, Earl Dean, I didn't expect to see you." She held up one of the business cards I'd left at the hatch. "Lucky Ollie had this, or I wouldn't have known where you were." "Come on in," I said. "You want me to hang that up?" "This is fine," she said. She laid her coat over the back of one of the guest chairs while she took a seat in the other. She was easily a head taller than me, and she'd probably fallen into the habit of bad posture as a teen in hopes of looking the same height as everyone else. The scent of bourbon hovered in the air around her, though she was sober as far as I could tell. I returned to my desk and sat down. "Is there some way I can be of help?" "More like I'm here to help you. Something came up I thought you ought to know about." "I can hardly wait." "Well, after you left the hatch yesterday, this fellow came in. I hadn't seen him for a while, but he knew Audrey pretty well because the two of them used to have these long heart-to-heart talks. This was a year ago, before she and Marvin started stepping out together. I haven't seen him since. I thought he must be an ex-husband or an old boyfriend, someone she didn't want Marvin to know about." "And was that the case?" "At the time, I wasn't sure, but I'll admit I was curious. He's a good-looking guy, mid-50s, tall, with curly gray hair, and these big old brown eyes. He and Audrey always had their heads together, and when I asked who he was, she brushed the question aside. They were a bad match, in my opinion. She was a good 10 years older than him, and no disrespect intended, he was much too handsome for the likes of her. I know that sounds terrible, but it's the truth." "Did he come in looking for her yesterday?" Earl Dean shook her head. "He was meeting someone else. This was a woman who didn't have any business at a place like the Hatch. She was more the country club type, if you know what I mean." "Close enough," I said. "What happened?" "Nothing much. They chatted for a minute or two, and then he ushered her out the side door. And that was the last I saw of them." Why tell me?
Well, that's just it. Back when this was going on, I asked Ollie who he was, and he told me his name is Lorenzo Dante. Have you heard of him?
I don't think so.
He goes by the name Dante, so nobody gets him mixed up with his dad, Lorenzo Dante Sr. Ollie says he's a gangster.
The father or the son?
Both. I guess the father's retired. Of course, I don't travel in those circles, but I hear this fellow has a hand in a number of shady dealings.
Such as what?
Well, he's a loan shark, for one thing. He also owns an import-export warehouse out in Colgate called Allied Distributors. I have a hunch Audrey worked for him.
My heart had started to thump because I'd seen that same warehouse the day before.
Why didn't you tell me this a week ago? I'd been busting my butt trying to figure out what she was up to.
This would have been a big help.
I got sidetracked, I guess. I was so upset thinking she killed herself, it didn't occur to me her death might be connected to her boss. It wasn't until I saw him yesterday the penny dropped.
Does Marvin know?
Let's put it this way. I told him straight out, but that doesn't mean he got the message. He doesn't want to hear Audrey was working for a crook. He thinks she's a saint, and he won't listen to anything else.
That's the same charge he leveled at me.
Oh, I know. It's called projection. I see it all the time at the hatch. You accuse someone else of having traits you refuse to acknowledge in yourself, she said. Don't look so shocked. I got a college education back in the day. I majored in psychology with a minor in fine arts.
Sorry, I'm just trying to take this in.
You'd think Marvin would be thrilled. He's convinced she was murdered, and this supports the claim, don't you think?
Well, I don't know about that, Earldine said.
Audrey and this Dante fellow were thick as thieves, if you'll pardon the pun. She worked hard. She was always on the road, and she made a ton of money. To me, that's the mark of success. Why would he kill her when she was so good at what she did?
Maybe she got too big for her britches and threatened to take over.
I guess it's possible. You heard what Marvin said. Somebody talked him into the notion she was tossed off the bridge because she knew too much. The question is, what?
Beats me, I said. I considered the implications. Based on the sketchy facts I had in my possession, I had no clue what she might have discovered.
Earldine fidgeted. What do you think I should do?
Well, if I were you, I'd go to the police.
I tried that. Before I came here, I went down to the police department and asked to speak to someone about Audrey's death. The fellow at the desk made a call and said Sergeant Pretty would be right out. I said never mind and hightailed it out of there as fast as I could. I don't like how his name keeps coming up. Anyway, I just hope Marvin doesn't find out I was here or he'll chew me a new one.
Chapter 24 After Earldine left, I went over my notes again. I'd never felt quite so enamored of my index cards. They were like pieces of a puzzle that would fall into place once I understood what I was looking at. I shuffled the cards and laid them out on my desk. I could arrange the facts in any order I liked, but the bits and pieces would come together only when I perceived their true relationships. The process kept my thinking loose. So I didn't get too invested in having the narrative line up the way I thought it should. For the moment, I was without direction. But instead of being discouraged, I saw this as an opportunity to stop and take note. It was like standing in a slow-moving stream with information flowing over and around me. I could turn in any direction and survey my surroundings while I debated where to cast my line. I turned up the card on which I'd noted the name of the real estate office offering the ramshackle cottages for sale, a company called Providential Properties. It would be interesting, thought I, to find out who the tenant had been and for what period of time. I pulled out the phone book and looked up the real estate office in the yellow pages. There was only one address listed, that being in Colgate, California. which suggested this wasn't a multinational company with branches in London, Paris, and Hong Kong. A chat with the realtor would be nice, and better in person than by phone. I stopped for gas and a trip to the ladies' room before I got on the 101, which gave me time to think about a cover story. Why would I be inquiring about run-down real estate? In my jeans and turtleneck, I looked shabby enough. I'd never bought property, even in pretense, and I had no idea how one went about it. What if I were asked for my home address, occupation, and my place of employment? I decided to make that part up, if and when it came to it. For all I knew, Providential Properties, like Helping Hearts Healing Hands, was a figment of someone's imagination. I found the office in a line of businesses on the main street that ran through Colgate. I passed the place, did a quick scan, and then parked down the block. Outside the office, I paused to look at the window display, showing photographs of properties available. Most appeared to be commercial, and I noticed then that the small print on the company sign said, Office, Industrial, Retail, and Investment Properties. It wasn't until I put my hand on the knob that I spotted a paper clock and a note dangling from a suction cup affixed to the inside of the glass. Back in 10 minutes. The clock hands had been set to 11. My watch said 11:45. I turned and checked for pedestrians up and down the sidewalk, thinking the returning agent might be in sight. While there were any number of people out and about, none was heading in my direction. I wasn't sure whether to wait or to give up altogether. I went into the shoe repair shop next door, which smelled divinely of leather, glue, paste shoe polish, and machinery. The fellow working behind the counter was restitching the strap on a knapsack. He was in his 70s and looked up at me over the half rims of his bifocals, his curly white hair brushing his shoulders. I said, Do you have any idea when the realtor next door might return? The sign on the door says 10 minutes, but that was 45 minutes ago. She went home. She does that sometimes when business is slow. Really? I wonder why she didn't just close up shop and be done with it. She hates to turn away a client. A lot of people come in here looking for her. I'll give you her business card. If you leave a message on her answering machine, she'll call you back. This would mean a second trip out, which annoyed me no end, but I couldn't see an alternative. I guess that'll have to do. He got up and crossed to the counter, where he opened a drawer and fumbled among the contents, before handing me a card decorated with smudged fingerprints. As I thanked him, my gaze dropped to the agent's name, Felicia Stringfield. I said, Felicia? Do you know her? I believe I've heard the name, I said. Does she handle residential properties? If she's given the opportunity, she's not one to refuse a request. Well, that's good, I said. I'll give her a call and maybe stop by again if she's going to be in. You want to leave your name and phone number? Don't worry about that. I'll get back to her. Thanks. I returned to my car and dug out my index cards. I removed the rubber band and rifled through them rapidly until I came to the notes I'd taken after my first meeting with Marvin. Felicia was the first name of the agent who was set to show Marvin and Audrey houses for sale on the day she disappeared. There could be a whole subset of agents named Felicia, but I doubted it. I would have loved confirmation, but I really didn't want to talk to Marvin at this point. If the agent was the same, it couldn't be a coincidence that she was offering cottages for sale or rent at an address that was tied to the consignment shop. I closed my eyes, running the facts down in my mind. I couldn't see a junction where all the points converged. I sensed the contours of the theft ring, and I knew some of the players by name. I also knew how, but not what, they moved between locations. The problem was I had no authority to act. At best, I could make a citizen's arrest, but I'd never set much store by the concept. If I managed to collar a crook, what would prevent his simply laughing it off and walking away? The minute I laid a hand on him, he'd respond with charges of assault. I'm a small-town private investigator. Bringing down an organization like this was the job of law enforcement. I found the nearest payphone and called Cheney Phillips's direct line. When he picked up, he seemed to recognize my voice, but I identified myself nonetheless. "Can I talk to you?" he said.